Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, and welcome to another episode of We Got This podcast. What does it take to create a truly exceptional business? Obviously, you need to start with a product that delivers great value, but that's not all. You also need the right combination of people, strategy, execution, and processes. Get any of these wrong, and your business does not realize its exceptional potential. Recently, I've been on a scouting journey looking for business leaders who I can learn from about how to find that right balance, that right combination, talking about the challenges they face in building businesses and creating efficient teams, and where does the most popular buzzword these days, culture, fit into all of that. I'm delighted to have with me Jakob Knudsen, the CEO of Butter. No, not the dairy product, Butter, as in the platform that makes collaboration not only efficient, but also delightful. And it's built for facilitators. If you're tired of Zoom, if you're tired of Google Meet, Teams, Slack, or whatever else you're using, you need to give Butter a go. I've been using it in the past few weeks, and I genuinely cannot remember the last time I've had so much fun using a new tool. So I'm really happy to have Jakob here because his approach has evolved over the years since he started the company. And I invited him here to talk to us more about that. We Got This showcases individuals and organizations that create people-focused workplace cultures to help it become the norm rather than the exception. It's something that will require a mindset shift, and probably not something that any of us can do alone. But together, we got this. Jakob, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me, Lech. I am very excited to be here.
it's great to have you. We've been talking a lot off air in the lead up to this, and it's genuinely been a lot of fun, and in a way a bit of an honor to be getting customer suggestion, customer service on how to use a tool from the CEO of a company. I have to say, that's the first. I've never experienced anything like that. But by the way, this is the type of service you might expect from Butter. I might got you into a lot of trouble here now, Jakob. The same thing, but just this shows just the dedication to the tool that I've had the pleasure to experience. You're not going to escape the question that everybody gets at the start of the podcast, and that is, when you were little, who did you want to be when you grew up?
Yeah, that was a super fun question that you're asking there, because I don't remember myself saying this, but my mom apparently said that I wanted to be ruler of the world, which is like a really weird thing, and I don't know whether it's like slightly megalomaniacal, yes, is the word, for a three-year-old, but you know, here I am today. So
the question that I got is, how far are you in realizing the dream?
I'm only at step 3 out of 10, you know, so give me time.
Okay. No rush. You know, take your time whenever ready. You know, the ruler of the free world.
We're getting 80 plus year olds that are ruling the biggest country in the world now, you know, so like given my 36 years of age, I'd say I've got plenty of time.
You've got some time. You know, I often say that when I hear the answers to these questions, I try and connect to what people do in the day to day now, what their job is. I have to say, I'm struggling here, Jakob, with what your dream was and what you said. I can guess trying to conquer and rule the world with collaboration tools, which I guess could be a milestone of sorts.
Mm-hmm. I love the segue. Yeah.
You love the segue. Good. Oh, wasn't it? Yeah, segue. But there you go. I'll use that segue. And if I can start with a question that I've been asking a lot of people recently, because I often get asked, what is culture? How do you define culture? And you know, I've got a few different ways of saying it. I say that it's just simply put, it's ways of working. I say that culture is like the oil in an engine. If the oil is good, it's nice and fresh, the engine runs smoothly. If it's not, the engine, you know, stalls, explodes, or at the very least uses more fuel than it's needed. So there's a lot of definitions, but what's also increasingly frustrating is that culture is a buzzword, and it actually doesn't mean anything anymore. So if I may ask you, how do you see that word, or is there a better phrase or word that you would use to describe?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I think it's one of those, as you say, one of these things that have become buzzwords to a very large extent. The best way that I've heard it defined, and I think the way that I personally kind of see ourselves the most and myself the most in when it comes to culture, is the kind of the collective behavior of a company and its people. And I really like the whole idea that culture is much more about behavior than it's about design. So what culture is not is the values that you write on your homepage. What culture is not is, you know, how many happy hours or poker games you arrange with your team, right? It's the behavior that people, they exude on a day-to-day basis when they interact with customers and when they interact with each other. I think that's the best way. And I think the way that I personally resonate the most with what culture, for instance, we've built in Butter.
Okay. And because we're talking about this before in a lead up to our recording, that your approach to not culture, but the way you approach building the business, building the team, building the environment, the way you work has changed, has evolved over the years. Before we launch into that, because I think that's where I'd like to spend a fair bit of time, but before we get into that, could you give us a little bit of a snapshot of the background of Butter, where you've gone, where you've been in the last few years from where you started as a company?
Yeah, I guess very quickly, right? So we started Butter during the pandemic. The earlier days of the pandemic, we were a failed startup team with myself and my two co-founders, Chris and Adam, who had worked together as a remote team before in another startup. And we're pretty excited about the whole concept of remote work. And with the COVID suddenly hitting, you know, it was becoming all the rage. The angle to Butter was we didn't really know what problem we wanted to solve. And it was incredibly important for us to solve the right problem with a software product. So we started doing trainings, basically transferring our best practices on how to work together as a remote team, how to collaborate as a remote team, to teams that were now forced to work remotely when they had previously been co-located. And that was kind of where the aha moment for Butter came, because we as workshop facilitators, pretty experienced workshop facilitators, had a ton of issues when it came to doing these online. As we were doing on Zoom, using tools like Miro, Mentimeter, Kahoot, a lot of stuff to create this interactivity and engagement in the sessions. And it just proved to be incredibly overwhelming for us as facilitators and proved to be very non-engaging for participants. We thought that, hey, there must be a better way. And that's kind of where Butter was born in mid-2020. Now, that also means that we were born from a remote team to begin with. Adam, my CTO and co-founder, we hadn't met until, was that spring 22, I think? So several years after having founded Butter, but we still built the company together. And one of the big thoughts there with building a remote team was that everything when you build a remote company, it needs to be more explicit, needs to be more thought through, it needs to be more written down and well communicated than if you're building a co-located business. Well, theoretically, you should also do that for a co-located business, but things will find their way easier in a co-located business than when you're building it fully remotely. And one of those things, as you allude to, was culture. So we started out very early on, I mean, early meaning within the first half year of us as a business, trying to define who we were at Butter. And maybe that was also like part of the wrong things. Like we were actually trying to define it, right? Which is good, but also has its weaknesses. And we spent a fair bit of time defining not values, but what we called operating principles, which is like operationalized values. I think we came to 8 or 9 of those. And it felt like a process. It felt like we were doing the right thing. We raised a fair bit of money as well and started recruiting people. And I think at our very, for context, you know, at our very top, we were 21, 22 people, I think. And for context, we're 13 people today. So we've had some, well, we became a bit bloated as an organization, hired too fast. And I feel much more comfortable about the size that we're at now, but fully remote across Europe and Asia only at the moment with people in Indonesia, Nigeria, Malaysia, Denmark, Germany, Netherlands. So it's a little bit of context of kind of where we're at. Like it's a fully remote company. We grew a lot. We scaled down a little bit. Now, one of the big things that we saw when we grew a lot was also that we ended up focusing a lot on the organization and on processes and, you know, who we were and those operating principles. We ended up revising them again and thinking about them and talking about them all the time. And that sounds like a good thing from a culture perspective, right? I mean, we're talking actively about us as an organization, about us as culture. But the thing is, like, again, the day only has 24 hours and your mind as a startup founder only has so much mind space. And that talking about the organization and about culture has to come from somewhere. And again, the most important thing for a startup to survive and thrive is building a product that people want and getting it in the hands of those customers. And the time was taken away from that, right? And it was especially time from us as founders, from me and my co-founder, Chris, who's a chief product officer and designer as well, and from Adam, the CTO. And that was not healthy for the organization. It was like, again, what I can best today describe as a navel gazing, right? Where we focus more on, playing house or building or playing like we're building a business, but our revenues were freaking negligible, right? And it took away like fixing critical problems on the platform and just to prevent or to discuss internal diversity. And to be perfectly honest, when you see a team picture, it's not exactly like we have a diversity issue. So that really came top of mind, like, wow, it's important for me to have an organization that is aware and where we reflect on who we are. But I think the key point is have an organization, and we will not have that organization if we do not build a product and build a business that is sustainable. So that's kind of where my mind shifted over time, and from like, let's make sure that we are super aware of what we build and spend a lot of time on us as an organization, to it's important. But if we don't have a business and a product in the first place that will allow us, we should first build a business and a product that kind of allows us to, or gives us a right to build that organization, if that kind of makes sense.
I think it makes perfect sense. I would argue with you on certain points, but I would put a couple of asterisks next to what you're saying, because you can't, there's no point in focusing on culture and not on the business, because if you don't have a business in 2 years' time and a year's time, you're not going to have a culture to have a company to have a culture of. If that makes sense, right? So it's about that thing, about that balance. The reason I find this topic fascinating, because a while back, I've realized that a lot of the work that I'm doing with my clients is actually undoing things that they've had in their DNA of how they operate, how they work together from early days. And that made me think, if you're a startup, a new organization, when is the time to actually being more intentional about agreeing on the ways you're going to work together in the organization? And I'm purposely not using the word culture here. And when is that time? And the bit that often gets misunderstood in what I say here is that doesn't mean is that you all of a sudden only focus on culture. No, the time when you start being more intentional can be literally 5-10% of your time. Just thinking, talking about it, doing something about it as you continue to build your business. And I looked at it from the perspective of investment. After which series of funding can that place care? And I realized it's somewhere around series A, series B. And you can correct me if I'm wrong, because you know that from the other side. I know it just from a theoretical perspective. Because the reason I think it's around somewhere series B, just before or after, is because the product's been vetted. It's usually more than an MVP. It's got some sort of client base. Most of all, you as a founder, as a company, have runway, right? You no longer have to worry about how am I going to pay the bills? Are we going to still be here in 6 months' time? No, I know that we're going to be here in 24 months for sure. So we've got that time. And that's kind of the logic I was following. I'm more than happy for you now to tell me how flawed that logic is.
So there's some things that you said that I very much agree with. Right. So the whole, I really like the ways of working part, because that is honestly the most important part. And I guess, like, now I said culture is about behavior. I think the most important part of that culture is internal behavior about how you work together as a team. I'd argue, honestly, you need to establish that from the very early days. Like, I'm talking pre-seed days. As soon as you've got more team members than just especially as a remote company. And again, I come very much at this from the remote perspective. As soon as you've got more people than just the founders working on stuff, and maybe even when you have it as a founders, it makes sense to make this somewhat explicit and spend just a bit of time on it. Now, I think the important part you said was like 5-10%. Yeah, right? I mean, it should not be too much. And I think the mistake that we made was over-engineering stuff too early. Like, again, we had, as I said, like, we spent time, we had workshops on how to define operating principles, and 8 and 9 of those came out, and we had workshops on how to implement those operating principles into day-to-day operations of the company, and blah, 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 right? I mean, that's just
why did you do that? Why did you feel like that's the thing that you needed to focus on?
Because we were hiring people, and I wanted to make sure we got the right people who worked together in the right way. from the very early stages, right? And I didn't know exactly how to do that, but this seemed like a good way to create some kind of common language and mm-hmm. common ways of working from the earliest days. How would you do that now, though?
Because that logic for me makes perfect sense. And actually, that's something that I often do with clients and believe they should do. How would you do that differently to what you've done?
So I think it's the over-engineering part that's kind of the key word here, right? It just make it more scrappy, make it more MVP-like in terms of culture. Like, what does culture MVP look like? And I'm not sure, right? But operating principles, maybe that's fine, but maybe, what do I know? Stick to three, right? Well, the three most important ones. Maybe let it develop a little bit more organically and don't set up, you know, 3-4 workshops in sequential manner at pre-seed stage. Maybe have some milestones internally where when we hit this, then we do that, right? Or have a much longer, like, so many things in startups are extremely short cycles, like release cycles of 1 to 2 weeks max, right? But with this one, the culture have a much longer cycle, except that. So you have explicit check-in points every 6 months, every 12 months and this stuff, right? So just make sure you don't hit barriers where, like you say, we almost kind of create self-control. So you don't end up with the navel gazing and the too much focus on this, right? I say that's probably how I'd approach it differently.
I like that. Most of all, I like you saying don't over-engineer culture. I think that's a very, very good phrase. And what I'm hearing, and I'm applying it to how I work, is actually trying to do just that intentionality, that 5-10%. Just do an MVP. It doesn't. It's never going, culture is never going to be a finished product. It's a living organism, happens all the time. So you can't you shouldn't be spending too much time, as you said, workshop after workshop and trying to get it perfect. Perfectionism, that's what's going to kill you. And I think that's the difficult. One thing I'm curious about, though, why do you think you focus on that so much? Was there an element that it was easier to focus on doing the culture bit than focusing on other parts of the of building the business?
So I love this. Y Combinator, they have this concept of fake work, right? Where, you know, they basically say that anything that is not talking to customers and building product is fake work, especially in the early days, right? That's what you just need to do. Going to conferences, doing startup like competitions, God forbid, right? I mean, those are horrible things. But I think that the slightly harder thing to say about fake work is this whole like playing house. I actually really like that concept as well, of playing house, right? Because you're trying to do organizational stuff that seems like, oh yes, this is super important, and yes, this is good. And sure, I'm not saying that it isn't important, but it is perhaps the hardest thing at that point in a business's life is building a product that people actually want to use and want to pay money for, right? So spend the absolute majority of time doing that instead of building an organization. And it's also easier because building an organization, that's something that a lot of people have done before. Maybe not your organization, but still, like, they're similar enough, right? Whereas building your product and especially solving the problem that you're solving is like hopefully something that nobody has ever done before, really, right? So therefore the path of least resistance is the building the organization bit, and that's where the mind space kind of automatically flows into at times, or might automatically flow into. So I think it's important to always stop yourself and ask, like, why are you actually spending time on this? What are you hoping to achieve? And are you literally just doing a very advanced form of procrastination?
I was just about to say, do you think that is a form of procrastination?
Everything is. I mean, it's probably better than scrolling Twitter, right? But, you know, I think when you reach a certain level, it is, you know, when you're sitting nitpicking, you know, wording on your values, you know, that's probably not what's going to make or break your business, right?
No, that's true. What I find funny, and that's one of the reasons I asked this question, is that it's very ironic, because in the situation that you described, that I've seen a lot of organizations be in, they try and over-engineer and overthink culture, spend way too much time on it than it's worth. And I can't believe I'm saying this, because I often is the other way. A lot of organizations don't spend enough time on culture, but the it's a different stages when and this is the irony comes in. When an organization is small, they're still building their business, their product, their MVP, they spend too much time on culture often, but not enough on the product. And then when they're more mature, when they've got a bigger organization, more structure, more processes, and already an established product, they don't have to worry about that. They actually spend even more time on that product rather than now having the time to do it on culture. And I often feel, is what is less painful to deal with.
Yeah. So I totally agree with you on the whole bit that as an organization grows, right, especially when you get to Series B stage, you've kind of got the product figured out, you've got the marketing channels figured out, you just need to kind of add oil, or, well, you need to scale the organization. So the most painful bit at that point actually becomes the culture bit and the organizational bit, whereas the product becomes a bit less painful, right? And that's why it's probably at that point easier to focus on the product than on the organization, and why we see people going through that there, like the least painful bit, the path of least resistance.
I guess so. Yeah, it's a tricky one. I guess with just human nature, we like to challenge ourselves, but we sometimes need a bit of a break, and I think that's that kind of balance that we're trying to strike in many cases.
Oh man, Mike, and I can see that on myself all the time. And I mean, so many productivity gurus also talk about that, and that's on an individual basis, right? I mean, but I think like the funny thing is this is like this just blown up on an organizational scale, right? Organizational leadership scale or whatever, right? Where you end up as a leadership team and to distract each other with the stuff that is less important than the important stuff at any given stage. And that's super dangerous, and that's why you should really kind of keep each other in check.
That's true. Because LinkedIn and all social media platforms, and even Google, if you look at it, you know, they're all, as I said, full of the buzzword culture. I'm curious, what are there any things that you, when you're on LinkedIn, because you're very active on LinkedIn, by the way, impressively so, with a lot of really good content on all matters to do with collaboration, how to use the tool and so on. So I highly suggest following Jakob, but you spend a lot of time there, so you must be seeing all the inspirational quotes and inspirational articles about culture, about well-being, about work-life balance and psychological safety. No doubt all of these things are important. Are you at that stage where you're looking at that and you go, oh my god, I've had enough of this? Yes. It's just that. And if so, which bits really, in the whole topic of how we work around workplace culture, that really drives you nuts and you can't take it anymore?
Yeah. Oh man, I'm gonna have a freaking crowd of pitchforks in front of my house when I say this stuff. But you know, like, I think the big part is like the work-life balance bit. I think in Scandinavia especially, but I think it's growing even more global, and I'm actually seeing it very much in the remote work scene for some weird reason. Like this whole idea, or not the idea, but like work-life balance is for sure important, but there's a almost understanding or a discourse now that working hard is a bad thing, and caring about and it's almost a sickness when you care about work too much, right? And as a founder who works quite a lot, and with colleagues who care a lot about building butter and who are employees who also work a lot, like I almost feel like we're getting shamed for working a lot and for caring a lot about work. And it has this mask of well-being and personal wellness and stuff on it, but it's a really nasty discourse. And I just feel like this drags the world into a pit of not giving a fuck about something that's amazing and you know, drive, and something that gives tremendous value and tremendous sense of like self-enlightenment and self-improvement to a lot of people. And that it's almost bad to care about work. And that's something that I really, really dislike. Now, I'm caveating this because I need to caveat it. Yes, of course you need to take care of yourself. Yes, of course you need mental wellness. Of course you shouldn't go into burnout. And that's not what I'm advocating. But I think that there's just a big difference between pushing yourself into burnout and just really, really caring about what you do every day and going into that with passion.
Absolutely. I think that's the crucial piece of discussion that's missing, the misunderstanding of balancing the two of getting satisfaction from what you do, not being afraid of hard work, but then also incorporating an element, I need time off, rather than continuously plowing on, because you know you will reach burnout. You can only so long run on a net half empty tank. So you run out of fuel. So you need that element of it, but it's not to do. And I think you're right that there's a confusion between work-life balance and vilifying hard work and effort, because there will be times where you will have to and want to work 12 hours a day for weeks on end. But then what's important in the work-life balance debate is what you do after. Is this a continuous state for weeks and months on end? That's when it's not sustainable. That's when the enjoyment, because you can only so long run on adrenaline and endorphins from getting the, you know, kicks out of what you do.
But now I see that is where, that is actually where I think that there's yet another really interesting perspective, namely, like, man, I work 60-hour weeks easy every week, and I've done that for literally years, right? And the secret, I think, or secret, I don't know whether it's a secret, right? But I think at least what enables me to do it is just this, a sense of control over how I work and when I work. Right. And a sense of like, I spend time working out. I spend time eating well. I spend time with my family, but I also deselect a ton of things. Like, I don't spend a lot of time with friends, which, you know, pros and cons of that. Right. I don't spend a lot of time on hobbies. I don't, like, there's a lot of things that I don't do, but like, I think I can easily, like, I think that the thing is not, it's not a sprinting, you know, working 60, 70 hour weeks and then, oh, resting and then sprinting again. It's more about like, how can you create that sustainability in your life that in important periods allow you to just consistently give it your all for a long, very, very long period of time. And that's more about like this whole integration of work and life, if that makes sense.
I had a guest called Wim Fouquet on this podcast a while back, and we're talking about work-life balance and how actually it's a myth for the reasons that we've just been discussing. Mostly the way I see it is because work and life are not opposing forces, so yes, you can't put it on the 100%. Other two. They're integrated. 100%. And yes. Wim introduced me to an interesting concept of energy balancing. So rather than having, you know, working 60 hours a week for 2 months and then crashing for a month and then doing that all over again, do it on a smaller scale, right? Based on a weekly basis, on a daily basis, whatever, based on how much energy you've got to devote to something, and do that. Because I love what I do, but I know that I'm very prone to actually overdoing it. So I have to physically say to myself, no, this weekend, laptop, in the wardrobe or whatever, closed off, right? I'm not touching it. And I have to be very intentional about it to be able to disconnect, because I'm, you know, it's also work as escapism. Rather than, you know, you might have, you're going through some tough times personally that you need to deal with, but it's easier to devote yourself to work than actually sit down and get in touch with what you're feeling, what's going on in your life, and how, for example, miserable or depressed you might be, right? It's easier to escape to work. And I'll raise my hand. I've done that. I do that. Unfortunately, I'm prone to doing that. And it's easy to do that. That's why, even though I genuinely do love what I do, but sometimes to love it even more, I need to take a break from it.
Yeah, I hear you. I hear you. And I hear you very much on the whole, like, when you take a break, you need to really know how to take a break. And that's something I've been, I wouldn't say I've been struggling with, but I've been learning how to do better over time. Like, I think it's over a year now, I've turned off all email and Slack notifications, for instance. I still have the apps on my phone, and I think that there's no way out, especially for a person in my position, to fully delete them. But I actually, over Christmas holidays, I deleted them from my phone even, right? Because I didn't need to see it right away, so I had to access them on my laptop when I needed to see them, right? But it is about creating these different, like, small paths of resistance to those habits of yours, so you can be present in the moment when you're present with your family, when you're reading a book, when you're doing other stuff outside of work to recharge and to balance.
I wasn't necessarily going to take the conversation there, but since we're talking about work-life balance, and something that I've been definitely feeling, not necessarily always being said, but often mentioned as well by people like yourself, people who run companies, who are either co-founders, founders, CEOs, that they feel a sense of loneliness in that position. It's not necessarily to do with the fact that it's lonely at the top, but there is an element, there's so much to do, and actually not always knowing what to do, how to feel about it, how's that, who to turn to, and everybody expecting you to have all the answers. Yeah. Is that something that you experience, or some sort of flavor of such feelings?
Yeah, 100%, right? I think there's so many different elements to this. I think one element is like this whole lonely at the top, which is true. And especially as a founder CEO, there are just certain things that I can't even, I can share them with my co-founders, but I don't always want to get their mind space on that. Like, say when I'm running an investment round, right, do the play-by-play. Oh, I talked to that person and they said no, and they said yes. And, you know, like having, like bringing them with me on the emotional roller coaster, there's no need for that, right? I need to take that off of the team, right? Ensuring that there's cash enough in the accounts always, right? This is just my, like, financials, budgeting, all of that shit, right? I mean, that's on my plate, and I don't need to give even my co-founders, and definitely not my team, a play-by-play of this, because that's just offloading my own roller coaster or my own emotions on them. So no need there. And that's definitely, there's a lonely at the top there, because who do I talk about this with? And like, I literally, from that perspective, I wouldn't have any. Now, I have a coach, and we talk with him every week, 1 hour every week. And I've done that for years now. And like, he's extraordinary. And I can recommend any founder that just has just a slight amount of cash on their company, because I, of course, I'm having the company pay for this, because like my mental state health is incredibly important to the company. I will really just warmly recommend that to any founder. So that's kind of the one piece, is this whole like lonely at the top, which I think is true. I think there are other parts, which is just people don't understand, like as a founder, people like your friends, your family, like they won't understand the way that you live your life. Like take one particular point, which I've had on my mind for a long time. That's the whole the financial non-linearity, or the non-linearity of your finances, right? So in most people's lives, they accumulate wealth on a linear basis. So they get a new, like they might get a new job, they might get a raise, they might get a promotion, then they earn more money, and then they earn more money, and then they buy a house, and then, you know, at one point they can buy a bigger house and use the money that they got from the other house, and right? They have this linear progression in their lives, right? They save for pension. As a founder, like this is very different. Like I have a salary now that is exactly the same as when I started working 13 years ago, right? It's not a bad salary, right? And it allows me to work and live, but it doesn't allow me to accumulate wealth. So all the wealth that I'm accumulating is in the company, right? And I do hope for a liquidation event, as it's so beautifully called, an exit of sorts at one point in the future. But that's what I'm banking on. And it's a very, like when you see all of your friends, there's a comparative thing where you see all your friends just, you know, getting houses, getting bigger cars. Like I live in a small apartment with my wife and kid, right? So when you see that happening, like it does trigger certain things in your mind. That's just like, I think super, like super basic human things in your mind, frustrations in your mind. But it also triggers questions like, oh my God, you don't have a pension? Like it, like people looking at me like I'm some kind of madman, you know, like, because no, like that just doesn't make any sense. And people don't understanding that, well, you know, I could jump like many, many financial wealth steps in very short spans of time if the right things happen and if my hard work pans out. So that's a totally different part of the whole founder thing, like this whole financial non-linearity. And it's something that I haven't really cracked how to deal with, because it's just, it's so different from the rest of society. And there's not at least in Scandinavian society, there's not a general understanding and acceptance of this. Yeah, I don't know whether that makes sense.
Well, it does make a lot of sense. Why here is obviously that's creating a lot of tension for you, both internally and externally. And I know you said that you haven't yet figured out how to deal with that, but what helps you in these situations? How do you tend to respond? Not necessarily tackle, but how do you tend to respond?
Yeah, to tend to respond, right? I mean, I normally think that others shouldn't give a fuck about my finances, so I normally just tell them to go care about their own stuff in a very nice way, right? Sometimes I explain this, right? I mean, so how I also tackle this is, like, conceptually I understand this, rationally I understand this, and I'm actually reasonably, like, I'm at rest with my decision to do this, and I know that this is what I'll do for the rest of my life, so I need to be at rest with it and accept it. But still, there's, I don't know, like, there's this basic human thing of being so different from the rest of society that does feel like it just grates at you, even though you've accepted it and understand it. It still grates at you on an ongoing basis. So you need to, like, I talk about it with my coach, I talk about it with my wife, who's also an entrepreneur, right? So you need to surround yourself with other people. I think that's a solution. Sorry, I'm going a little bit in. I think the whole solution is to surround yourself with other people that are roughly in the same situation and can understand you and communicate a lot with them, because that's the only way to really not feel totally ostracized or different from the rest of society, is by having some kind of a group.
you actually answered the question I was going to ask you. Do you feel alone in that you feel that way, or do you, obviously you must have a circle of people, similar co-founders, CEOs that you deal with, of whether it's a startup or established company, doesn't matter, but that feel they feel the same way. But from what you're saying, that is the case, that a lot of other CEOs experience that as well.
Yeah, it is, and it's good, and it's nice, and it's. I think that combination of having a coach, which I think is super important, and having a peer group whom you can talk to and vent frustrations and compare notes with, is also equally important. So yeah.
Thank you very much for sharing that insight, because I know it's a personal bit of information that you shared with us, and something close to the chest. So I really appreciate the openness that you have to be able to do that, because as I said, a lot of people must be feeling the same way. You know that just from what you just said, that you've got a group of peers who experience the same thing. So just knowing in that case as a person in charge that being lonely is one thing, but there's an element that people just simply don't understand the sacrifices they have to make.
Yeah, sacrifice. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah, I think until you run your own business of whatever size, even if it's a one-man operation, versus when you're an employee, that's when you get a different appreciation of what that means.
100%. I mean, you must get it too, right? I mean, it is this whole thing. Like, it doesn't really matter if you're running a one-man operation or like a several-person operation. There's just this. Yeah, I guess this, I described it as loneliness is probably the best part. But on the other hand, that like it comes with the flip side of an extreme amount of control and freedom, right? Which is, by the way, also what allows me to work as many hours and with this high level of passion as I do. So the sacrifice is so much worth it.
I would argue that actually running a one-man operation, it's much easier than running a company that's got people in it that you've started, because I'm, if I'm a one-man operation, I only look after myself. It's only my bills that I have to worry about.
Yeah.
When you run a company, you've got the additional responsibility of the people that work for you. And obviously, apart from probably being obliged by law to have to pay them, so you have to sacrifice your own salary first, so you pay them first, on a human level, it's like, they've trusted me to be in charge, to look after them and the business and so on. So I owe them for that. So I need to look after them first, pay the salary, and then hopefully there's enough left for me at the end of the day.
Yeah, and it's a weird, I think to some extent you're right. There's pros and cons to everything. On the other hand, they actually, like, funnily enough, like, I pay them to do stuff. And, so they do stuff for me, or for us, to build stuff, right? And as a one man, like, you everything stops with you. And if you don't do stuff, then nothing ever happens, right? Which is also tough in that manner. So I think pros and cons to everything, man.
indeed. If I may close us off a little bit in a bit of a bookend or a loop, we started talking about your approach to culture changing over the years. I'd like to maybe ask a question around how you approach it now. So going forwards, what are some of your, you use the word operating procedures or principles, sorry. Do you have anything like that just for yourself, how you approach that in terms of building and focusing on how your teams run, how you create and make the teams efficient? Because in the work that I do, I often can focus on the bigger picture, which I get pulled back by the clients that I'm working with saying, like, that's fantastic. We want to be there. Before we get there, before we get to that piece of work, there's actually a bunch of shitty little smaller things that we need to solve in terms of how we operate and how we communicate and things like that actually are doing our heads in. Have you got things like that? And if so, how do you tackle them?
Yeah, I guess I do, right? So I do, but not a lot of it's codified. So I have some things that are very codified in terms of how I operate. That's mostly in terms of prioritization, and that's mostly in terms of personal prioritization and how I ensure that I spend my time on the right stuff. So I wouldn't even call it culture or organization or anything. It's just very laser focused on that. But aside from that, I do have ways or parts of the operation that I focus more on, but it's just not codified yet. I really like this whole concept of like the manual of me, I think, or like you have a lot of different names and like how do you work as a person. And it's one of those things that I've actually wanted to create for a long period of time, but I just haven't gotten around to. I think it's something that we'll for sure introduce in not far future.
Those listening to this podcast, you can't, well, you may do, but probably not, you can't hear me smiling, but I'm standing here in front of the microphone grinning at the possibility of an idea that I've got that I'll run in relation to what you just said, Jakob, about, you said manual. I call it guide to me. It's actually one of my favorite cultural micro practices that I give to my clients is having that. And it's not just doing that as everybody individually for themselves and just sharing it, but you can actually turn it into a very simple but fantastic sort of team building activity where you share that with people. What I'll do, I'll include the kind of concepts of that in the show notes. I'll run you through what I've got in mind when we're done. But I think it's a fascinating concept. It saves so much trouble understanding yourself because we're so often on autopilot. So it helps ourselves individually. But then also, you know, there is this tendency. When we argue with somebody, we get annoyed with people. And it happens in work relationships and personal relationships where we go, oh, they should have known, or she should have known. And then my question often is when I hear that, it's like, should they? Really? How? And then you realize, they shouldn't, because they're not mind readers. I didn't tell them. They couldn't have known. They didn't have that piece of information, right? Sometimes they should have and they just didn't. And then that's fair enough. But in most cases, there was no way they could have predicted that unless they are mind readers. So I'm glad that you mentioned that. That's something that you're striving for, because I think it's a place to be. As always, as with most guests, we could be talking for forever and a day, and every single guest has always a standing invitation to come back in the future, and it's the same obviously for you. So we'll put a comma, we won't put a full stop, we'll put a comma in our conversation. But I am curious about what have you got coming up in the next few months. What are you really looking forward to, or are you excited about with the product, with Butter, where you go in professionally, personally, you know, anything that you really, really excited for?
Oh man, like I think one big thing that I'm super excited about is, like, again, Butter is a product that's built for facilitators, because we believe that facilitation is one of the skills, if not the most important skill, that unlocks synchronous remote collaboration. And what we're working on now is an AI co-facilitator. The whole idea that, again, AI's done so much stuff and there's a lot of great things out there. But again, in a lot of sessions, it's honestly really, really hard to facilitate something by yourself. And a lot of people rely then on co-facilitators to, you know, pick up what's happening, like get a sense of the room, answer questions in chat, all of that stuff. And that's one of the areas where, especially for solo facilitators, we wanna help that out with a buddy that can kind of can pick up those things and support in session in real time. And that's like, and especially the real time part is like super complex, super difficult, not because technically, but like how do you make sure people aren't like brains aren't overwhelmed totally by information coming in, etc. How do you feel that in the right way? How to make sure that it does the right things? So it's like conceptually and like from a like professional conceptual perspective, I'm excited about this. From a technical, like, oh, what will it enable users to do? I'm excited about this. From all perspectives, it's something that I just think it's super fun to kind of begin building. So I think that's the biggest thing that I'm excited about.
I've gone from being all smiles to standing here not very impressed, because what you've just said has the potential to put me out of my job, and I'm not sure how I feel about that.
Co-facilitator left.
It starts with co-facilitator, and I'm going to be the co-facilitator, and then I'm going to be the no facilitator.
No, that's not possible.
But it is something that I'm curious about how that can be incorporated, because I know there are consultants who specialize in different aspects of consulting, of supporting businesses, that are actually building tools like their AI equivalents that their clients can use to be able to ask questions that they would normally ask the consultant. And I get that as a stepping stone towards something else, but I'm concerned that might lead to something that doesn't reflect of what the organization is, right? And that's kind of an interesting, it's a whole topic in its own right, that's worth definitely discussing in any aspect. So I'm not going to go into it.
But you're totally right. And as with all things, like it's this whole use with caution. And I actually think that AI consultants is a very dangerous area to move into, because there's just enough context. It has enough context to give a credible answer, but you don't know whether the answer is correct, right? It's just like this, sort of just a little bit of a detour here, but like there's this new, I think it's called ErnieBot, which is China's ChatGPT, which when you ask the question of where COVID-19 stems from, it says it was like America, it was the US that did a particular type of vaccine, and then suddenly, you know, it came to Wuhan and boom, you know. So yeah. It's because the data it has is all these conspiracy theories from the deep web in China, and that's just what it's feeding out, right? And it's the same thing and it says with such credibility, and that's the same problem that you might face with AI consultants, right? That they might say, it might say things with a super high level of conviction that is just like utter crap or crazy, right? So I think that that's super dangerous. And that's why, like, for us, like the whole way, everything that we're designing and thinking through is as a support system, as a support model, where, you know, the whole like shit in, shit out, it's super real, right? So we need to make sure that whatever comes in and however it can support the facilitator in real time, that's the important part. But it should always go through a human. It should always go through the person, through an experienced facilitator that kind of knows how to deal with the information that they're getting.
But that is, I didn't know about what you just said about the Chinese ChatGPT. That is scary.
Oh my god, it's scary, right?
We need to end. No doubts about that. I don't want to spend on a scary note. But I think the entirety of the conversation has weighs this, balances this out for sure. So an absolute joy, pleasure, and privilege in many ways to be able to talk to you. Thank you for sharing your insight as a CEO, but most of all, sharing some of the personal stuff around the challenges and the loneliness that you face. So thank you very much for that. And as I said, as every guest, you do have a standing invitation to come back. Even though you just said that you're trying to put me out of a job, but I'm not going to hold it against you because your tool's great. Thank you very much.
And thanks so much for having me, Les.